Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. The thread question is up later in the show, but we're in depth now on understanding what the GOP health plan may mean to you. House Republicans are planning to hold a vote today on their replacement for Obamacare, but they're fighting opposition from colleagues, resistance from GOP governors, and confusion from voters. At 10 o'clock today, we'll talk about the politics of trying to get the American Health Care Act passed. This hour, it's the economics of it and who it will affect most. Two guests today to help us sort it out, and your questions, of course. If you've used the healthcare exchanges to buy insurance, of course, in Minnesota, that's MinSure. What are you concerned or confident about the GOP plan? If health insurance has been too expensive for you, particularly if you're in your 20s, what concerns you or gives you confidence about the GOP plan? So if you've used MinSure or in our five-state area here, some other form of the exchanges, I'd like to hear what concerns you or what gives you some confidence about the GOP plan that may replace Obamacare and may change the way those exchanges work. And if health insurance has been too expensive for you, particularly if you're in your 20s, you're among those young invincibles, what concerns you or gives you confidence in this new plan? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our guest today, Leighton Koo, is director of the Center for Health Policy Research at George Washington University, and he's with us today from Washington. Leighton, I hope first names are all right with you, and welcome. Good to have you on the show.
That's fine. Happy to be here.
Allison Kojak is with us. She's the health correspondent for National Public Radio. She has a very busy day. So, Allison, welcome. Really good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Carrie.
So, Allison, what I thought I would do is just set a quick foundation here. Between Medicaid expansion, the exchanges, and younger people staying on their parents' plans, do your numbers jive with the idea that Obamacare appears to have covered 20 million Americans who didn't have health insurance? Is that right?
That seems to be the right number, the closest we're going to get. You can't always tell exactly who may have had an individual insurance before that then bought it through the exchanges. But that's the official number that the government has given and that many private researchers have also found.
And Leighton, to make this clear, Americans paid for this, should we say, with changes in reimbursements to Medicare and Medicaid, with taxes on high earners, and through some projected savings on uncompensated care. Have I covered that, or were there more ways that we were paying for Obamacare?
Those are basically the ways. So the original plan by the Congressional Budget Office indicated that the Affordable Care Act was budget neutral, and in fact, over time, saved money for the federal government.
I want to talk about what's going to happen with Medicaid, because this is where there's a lot of concern from Republican governors and obviously from some members of the House. Leighton, I think, again, because I know the details of this are kind of confusing, how did Obamacare change Medicaid to bring more Americans in to insurance? And then we'll talk about some of the other changes that this new bill would make.
Sure. What happened under the Affordable Care Act was that Medicaid was expanded. Originally, the plan was that Medicaid, which traditionally didn't serve any childless adults across the country, and then you had to be very poor as a parent, and that would vary from state to state. It said in all the states that the floor should be brought up to people just above the income, above the poverty line, to 133% of the poverty line. What happened? The Supreme Court in 2012 said this was optional for states. So what happened was 31 states in the District of Columbia said we want to expand Medicaid. 19 states have not so far.
And Allison, for Medicaid, the concern here financially for these governors is unless this is going to change in the last minute, and I'm sure you'll tell us about that, it appears that they will block grant Medicaid, and the states, when that money comes up short, the states will have to fill it in. Is that right?
It's a little more complicated than that, but that's basically it. There's a couple of things going on. One, they freeze that Medicaid expansion. So that population that got coverage under the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, they can stay in as long as they are signed up by January 1st, 2020. However, if they cycle out of Medicaid because they make a little too much money during one period of time, they can't re-enter. And this is a population of people who work, and sometimes their income goes up and sometimes it comes down. And so they tend to cycle in and out of eligibility quite a lot. So the concern is, one, that those people will suddenly not have health insurance anymore.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, the second is that block grant you were talking about. There's what the bill does is it allows states to choose either to get a certain amount of money, fixed amount of money per Medicaid recipient, mm-hmm. or a fixed sum altogether, just one amount of money from the federal government to pay for Medicaid. So it doesn't necessarily guarantee that those people who have Medicaid will have, that the states will have adequate money to cover all their medical needs.
And so, Leighton, where this concern comes in for governors is if you don't want to remove people who have been on Medicaid, and we'll talk about who those people are in a second, states would then conceivably be looking at finding the money to keep everyone who's already in covered.
Well, they're twin problems. One is that states, in many cases, will be forced to drop some of the expansions that they already have, as well as that they may be forcing states to shrink down because of this block grant per capita cap system that Allison just mentioned. To give you a sense of the scope of this, an earlier estimate by the Congressional Budget Office said that by 2026, by about 10 years from now, about 14 million people would lose their Medicaid coverage. So that's a lot of people. That's about one-fifth of the people on Medicaid by that time. And by 2026, the amount of money that would be cut would be a 25% cut in the Medicaid budget. Now, that's actually an early estimate. Some of the changes that are expected to be made will be cutting Medicaid even more deeply than that. So this is the lowball estimate of the impact of those changes. And so governors are going to have a horrible problem. They'll be faced with a dilemma. Do we want to pony up with extra state money to replace the money that the federal government has taken away, or do they want to cut the people off Medicaid? And so that'll be a huge amount of harm to their constituents.
Call here for you, Allison, from Sharon in Rochester. Hi, Sharon. What's your situation with this, and what are you thinking about it?
Well, I have two. I'm both a consumer and a provider. And I'm 60 years old with a pre-existing condition, self-employed. I will lose my health care, or it will be so expensive that I can't. Years ago, Minnesota tried the high-risk pool.
Yes.
And what happened with that is the insurance companies very quickly shoved people off insurance, saying, well, you can go to the high-risk pool, which turned out to be way too expensive. And I actually went several years without health insurance. And so my concern is that my concern as a provider, I'm a provider of mental health,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, this carving out of mental health, chemical dependency, maternity, none of that makes sense. A small, very small portion of our health care dollar is mental health or chemical dependency. I think it's, last I looked, like less than 5%.
Okay.
So we're not saving anything, but we're certainly making people vulnerable. And we can't anticipate when we need a lot of these services. So if you have something happen in the middle of the year and your employer or your insurance doesn't cover that, that's just too bad. You can't go back and pick it up.
Okay, Sharon, let me do this. I wanted to be clear here about the pre-existing condition. Allison, this bill, the new GOP bill, does not allow insurance companies to exclude people for pre-existing conditions, right?
It doesn't. But there's right now what is being debated in Congress as Republicans try to get more votes for this bill is whether to get rid of what's called the essential health benefit. That's basically a list of things that insurance policies have to cover. And so, you know, right now it says you do have to cover mental health benefits. So if you're a person with a mental health condition and they get rid of the requirement that an insurance policy has to include that, insurance companies will just offer insurance that doesn't cover it at all. And so you can get insurance, but it won't cover your condition.
Leighton, let me follow up on that for a minute, and then we'll come back to something else that Sharon asked. A Dr. Porter here on Twitter says, how can the GOP cut these essential coverages that Allison was just talking about, like maternity, mental health, and ER visits, and call their plan health insurance? Isn't this something that they took out of the bill to satisfy some of these more conservative members of the Freedom Caucus and other places? They were concerned about that.
That's certainly what they've been talking about. The Freedom Caucus has been concerned that the bill, as it stands today, sometimes they've called it Obamacare light. And so they want an even more severe bill. The trade-off, though, is that many people could lose protections that their health insurance will have coverage for things like mental health benefits, maternity benefits, and so on. So it's a very risky step to take politically. And they're procedural problems because this will create problems in the Senate.
I want to come back just for a minute here before we go to more calls on Medicaid, because I think there is a misassumption about who it is that actually gets Medicaid. So, Allison, this is actually from a story that NPR aired today. Matt Salo, he is head of the National Association of Medicaid Directors. Mm-hmm. And listen to his description of who gets Medicaid benefits.
Most people, when they think about Medicaid, they think of it as sort of a low-income, working population welfare healthcare program. But what really comes as a big surprise to almost everybody is that that's not where Medicaid spends most of its dollars.
Where does Medicaid spend most of its dollars, Allison?
Medicaid spends most of its dollars on covering people with disabilities, severe disabilities. And it's because those people tend to also be lower income because they can't work and support themselves. And the second population that Medicaid covers, elderly people, especially elderly people in long-term care. And again, it's an issue of if you had a job and good insurance at one point, but now you're in a nursing home, chances are your income isn't covering your expenses. You become low income, you qualify for Medicaid. So there's this huge portion of Medicaid that covers people who are the most needy in the country. And I think most people focus their policy debate on this idea that able-bodied men should be working, and those are the people they're thinking about when they want to cut money to Medicaid, when really that most of that money is going to the neediest population in the country.
This is a conversation, if you've just tuned in, to try to explain some of the economics of the health care bill that House Republicans would like to replace Obamacare with. There's a lot of confusing details about who's in and what the coverage will mean, and we're trying to break down some of the economics on it this morning. At 10 o'clock, we talk specifically about the politics, and the political junkie is one of a series of guests on that. Leighton Koo is with us. He's director of the Center for Health Policy Research at George Washington. And Allison Kojak is the health correspondent for National Public Radio. You've been hearing her a lot lately on NPR. I'm asking you if you've used the healthcare exchanges here, MinSure, some other exchanges in other states in our area. What are you concerned or confident about? What do you like about the GOP plan? And if you're concerned about it, I'd like to hear about that as well. And I'd also like to hear from some of you young invincibles, you 20-year-olds, because the risk pool didn't work as well as it was expected to under Obamacare because not enough young and healthy people bought in. So when you hear the details of the GOP plan, does this sound like something that you'd want to afford, that you'd want to buy health insurance through? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter, at Carrie NPR. Here's Mark Leighton, who asks on Twitter, discuss the different effects of current individual mandate penalty versus the 30% premium increase penalty to reenter the market. The individual mandate is under Obamacare. You have to have health insurance. Will you talk about the differences here?
Allison or me?
To you, Leighton.
Okay.
Yeah.
So right now, there is what's called an individual mandate. If you don't have insurance, in most cases, unless you're very poor, you will have to pay a higher amount in taxes, and that's the so-called mandate. Instead, that's being done away with, but the new health care bill would say that there's no mandate. But on the other hand, if you skip insurance for even a month or, no, I guess it's 2 months or more, then the next time you need to purchase insurance, it can cost as much as 30% more. So it's not as though it's saying you can't be insured or you can't be uninsured. But on the other hand, if you want to get back in the game after having, you know, losing your job or having a problem, you can pay as much as 30% more for your health insurance. That's actually a bigger penalty, typically speaking, than the federal tax penalty that's involved with the insurance mandate today.
So, Allison, do you think the effect of that will essentially be to, you know, get close to universal coverage or not?
You know, there's a real debate there, and it largely depends on how much the insurance costs. Because right now, the government will offer a tax credit to these young invincibles of $2,000 a year to buy insurance. If they can get a policy around that price or a little bit more, chances are a lot of them would buy that insurance using the tax credit, and it won't be too much skin out of their bank account. But if the insurance premiums remain high, then they probably would not opt in until they needed insurance, at which point you have this problem of more what they call adverse selection, more sick people buying in and healthy people staying out. Because if I think, oh, I could go 3 years without paying the penalty, and the penalty is $700 or $800, and then I have to pay 30% more if I need it,
right?
You know, maybe I'll opt for that risk.
Right. And maybe I'll never need it, right? That's kind of the gamble that you're taking there. What do insurers do about that? That's got to be a pretty serious concern for them.
They are. They're very concerned. And I talk to actuaries and insurers, and I talk to people like Layton, who are concerned that this will make the risk pool worse than it is now. And the risk pool, we mean a mix of healthy people and sick people to balance out the risk to the insurance company. And then insurance premiums will go up even further if the risk pool gets worse.
You know, Layton, I should ask you. I mean, I made a statement there in that last question that said the risk pool never really worked as it needed to under Obamacare. Is that true in your view?
The risk pool worked fairly well, and it varied from place to place. So I'm here in Washington, D.C., and actually in our health insurance exchange, we had a very balanced pool. We had the larger proportion of young people in the country. There are certain unique reasons in D.C. why that happened, but partly it was because of the way we managed our practices and how we managed outreach that other places didn't do as successfully. So there were things that could have been done to bring more young people into the health insurance pool. But nonetheless, the point that Allison makes is correct, that in the end, it's entirely conceivable that the changes will make health insurance more expensive for everybody, including young people. And in fact, the risk is even more so for older Americans because the way the new health insurance tax credits are supposed to be set up under the new bill are essentially speaking less generous to senior citizens when you consider that their costs are going to be so much higher because of changes in what's called the age band for health insurance premiums.
Let me follow on that, Layton. If you are the AARP, as you know, is opposed to the GOP plan, and their numbers say if you're 55 years old and you earn $25,000 a year, your health care is going to cost you $2,300 more per year. If you're 64 and you earn $25,000, ARP says your premiums are going to cost $4,400 more per year. Does that match your calculation?
Well, it's going to vary from place to place, but the basic math is correct, that older people, and I can now count myself in that population, would have to be paying more because of the changes that are going on. So I think the Republican architects thought that this could bring costs down for young people, and it might in some cases, but again, because of this continuous coverage gap problem, some young people actually may face higher premiums than they do today. And in general, older people, generally speaking, face much higher insurance costs than they do today.
Mark says on Twitter, "I have a physical disability. Medicaid enables me to live independently and hold a job. The proposed cuts would upend my life." Kitty says, "I'm going to be 22 this June. Thanks to government health insurance, my disabled mother and myself have always had insurance." And to the phones to Hannah in Chanhassen, Hey, Hannah, hi. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hi. I wanted to call in because this is the first time I used the insurance exchange in Minnesota.
Yeah.
And I'm in my 50s, and I was a person who hung on to their private Blue Cross Blue Shield insurance until they let go of that 5% of the population that they were insuring last year.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of slow to accept an insurance exchange and worried about it. And so I watched my premiums go for a family of four from, you know, $14,000 to $18,000 to $24,000 a year.
Wow.
The last year I was part of that, because the pool of people who they insured had gotten so small.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I finally used the insurance exchange under the Affordable Care Act, now my policy is like $9,000 a year. It is the smallest it's been in, you know, 10 years. And so I'm really afraid of losing that when they put a new health care act in place.
Really glad for your call, Hannah, because I wanted to talk to Allison and Layton about premiums. Allison, what are the projections about what's happening with premiums? Because the GOP says that's part of the reason that the ACA, Obamacare, is in a death spiral, right, and is going to collapse in on itself. So what happens with premiums under the new act?
Okay, I just want to stop you and say there is some debate about whether that death spiral
absolutely.
Is, but I won't get in the middle of that
no,
right now.
No, we'll talk about that too. Absolutely.
The projection that the Congressional Budget Office made is that initially premiums will go up quite a lot. And that has to do with people dropping out, younger people dropping out and that kind of thing. And that over time, the premiums will go down again and would, in the end, I think after 10 years, be slightly lower than they would under the Affordable Care Act. But the reasoning behind that isn't always very good either. If you dig into the CBO report, some of that suggests that it'll be because more younger people will buy in at a later time because there'll be lower benefit policies that are cheaper available. And at the same time, people like our earlier caller who are in their late 50s, early 60s will see the cost of their premiums go up so much that they stop buying insurance altogether.
Wow. Layton, what would you add to that?
I think the analysis from CBO is plausible. Again, some of the new changes that are being discussed, such as doing away with the essential health benefits, might bring premiums down a little more, but on the other hand, will do away with guarantees for certain sorts of coverage. The other thing that's important to bear in mind is why premiums may go down over time is because of the expectation that health insurance will essentially thin out over time under the new health reform bill, so that, for example, deductibles, which are already very, very high for many people, particularly those purchasing low premium plans, those deductibles will be even higher. So you might have health insurance premiums that on a monthly basis are lower, but if on the other hand you want to see the doctor or you need to go to the hospital, your out-of-pocket costs are going to be much higher than they were before. So there's this trade-off, and that's the mechanism by which insurance premiums could become lower. Don't necessarily mean your actual health care costs are going to be lower, and in fact, if you get sick, your health care costs are going to be a lot higher.
So check my facts on this, Layton. Didn't the increase in premiums, which before Obamacare were rising steadily, didn't the acceleration of those increases slow down in the first several years? And are there any specific mechanisms that you can point to say, and they will slow even further under the new ACHA?
That's the area where, as Allison mentioned, there's speculation. So when I speak to different economists, there are different reactions as to how it might happen. The Congressional Budget Office is a fair sort of middle point of the expectation where they'll initially go up for people because a lot of the healthy people will drop out. They may slowly come down again, but that doesn't mean they're going to come down for everybody uniformly. And that's just talking about the monthly cost for health insurance. If the trade-off is there are more plans that are sold that are low premium but have very high deductibles or very high coinsurance, then in that case, your actual net cost for health insurance could be higher. And I think that's the likely trade-off.
Okay. Allison, what would you add to that?
Well, yeah. Excuse me. That's actually that's by design. And I think that's important to point out. There is a very strong sort of ideological belief among Republicans, and it bears out in economic theory, that the more people have skin in the game, the more they have to pay attention to their health costs, the less they'll use, the less waste there will be. So the idea is a system like this may overall, over the long term, bring down health care costs, writ large throughout the country.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean it doesn't create pain in the meantime.
Got it.
And it also suggests that there might be less money available because there's not this blank check from the federal government chasing health care, and therefore less money available, lower prices.
Let's say something again about this death spiral thing, because I'm glad you flagged that. That, as I said, that is something that the GOP says. The numbers don't necessarily back it up. Do a lot of Americans believe it?
I think a lot of Americans do believe it. And I think it depends. There are certain markets that are really in trouble. There are states where there's only one insurance company offering plans, and those insurers are thinking about leaving. So there are problems in the market, but those problems can be corrected through things that are less than repealing the entire Affordable Care Act. And then there are really healthy markets, like Leighton mentioned. You know, Washington, D.C. is doing quite well. The whole state of California is a very healthy insurance market.
Let's see here. I had somebody, Kathleen, on Twitter says, I'm not an invincible now that I'm 33, but tax credits aren't a huge incentive for millennials. We can't afford to wait for tax season. And to Jose in Minneapolis. Hi, Jose. What's your own situation with this?
Hi. I just have a question.
Sure.
I was wondering, every time I get in some situations with my friends, or we get in situations like we need emergency room service,
mm-hmm.
who pays for that? Because many of my friends don't have insurance. And every time that we need, like, stitches or, I don't know, broken ankles or something like that, we run to the emergency room. And we don't pay the bill when it comes back. I mean, I know for a fact, I know a lot of guys, 25, 27, 24, they don't pay their bill. It's a lot of money.
Jose, are you in your mid-20s as well?
I'm 25.
And when you need medical care, you go to the ER?
Yeah. I mean, like, just last week, a friend and I, we were replacing this window from his car, and he cut his finger. He needed a stitch. And we went to the emergency room, and he also had insurance.
Right.
And obviously, they didn't deny the service. They did help him on everything. But then after that, I know he won't pay for that. It's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And he doesn't have it. So talking to my friends about this, about this insurance issue with the invincibles, like you like to call them.
Uh-huh.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Not so invincible when you've cut your finger and you need to go to the ER. This is a good question. Leighton, will you address this, please?
Sure. There are various ways in which this is paid for right now. In many cases, if you're poor and you have this accident, even though you're uninsured, there's a way that Medicaid can step in sort of in an emergency to pay the bill. So that's one possibility that exists right now. And that at least right now, that would continue to be going on in the law. If you're totally uninsured and can't get Medicaid, then in that case, what happens is the system has to absorb the cost. So part of this may be borne by the hospital, and the hospital in turn may have to jack up prices for everybody to cover that loss for the emergency room service that was provided to your friend. Now, I'll say your friend is not necessarily going to get off scot-free, because in many cases, essentially speaking, this goes down into something where it's known from a credit report basis that your friend has didn't pay a bill that he was supposed to pay. So because of this, in the long run, if he tries to get a credit card, tries to get some other form of credit, he's going to run into some problems.
Conversation, if you've just joined us, about the economics of health care, what the ACA and Obamacare did compared with the ACHA, or the GOP plan, apparently not yet called Trump Care, that that is going to be debated and apparently voted on the House floor today. Allison, I should check this with you. Does it look like the vote is going to happen even if it's very, very late today?
It's unclear. Right now, we have the latest I got, which is just a few minutes ago, is that the Speaker of the House has asked for what some sort of rule waiver that would allow them to consider the bill with changes on the House floor today, which would mean they would waive this rule that normally they need 36 hours to consider the bill before they vote on it.
Okay.
So they're trying to get it done. We've heard it wouldn't be until the evening if they manage to vote on it at all.
All right. So Allison Kojak with us. She's a health correspondent for NPR. And Leighton Koo with us from the Center for Health Policy Research at George Washington University. And your calls and your questions. I really appreciate hearing how you're using the health insurance that you have. Love hearing from some of you 20-somethings and millennials about whether dropping the idea of universal coverage, but perhaps giving you access to plans that were more affordable, probably less coverage, but maybe more affordable, whether that would lure you into the health insurance market. And I think our discussion benefiting from your own thoughts and your experience on this. 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, of course, at Kerry, KERRI NPR. A look at the latest news, and when we come back, we'll continue the conversation. I actually also want to dip in a little bit more on this idea of how the politics may shape the changes that are going to be made, and this could be happening as we speak to this bill. So we'll talk with Allison and Leighton about that on the other side of news. But to Mike Moen now. Hi, Mike.
Hello, Kerry. The Islamic State group says the deadly attack outside the British Parliament in London yesterday was carried out by one of its soldiers. The claim comes after British Prime Minister Theresa May noted that police know the identity of the British-born man who went on a car and gun rampage at Parliament. May says he once was investigated for extremist links, but was considered a peripheral figure. She did not disclose his name. May says police believe the man acted alone, and there's no reason to believe imminent further attacks are planned. The GOP's long-promised legislation to repeal and replace Obamacare faces a showdown vote in the House later today. An account by the Associated Press, at least 26 Republicans said they opposed the bill, enough to narrowly defeat the measure. Frenzied last-minute wheeling and dealing are underway on Capitol Hill and at the White House. Top Senate Democrat Charles Schumer is now officially on record as opposing President Donald Trump's choice for the Supreme Court. Schumer said he would lead a filibuster against appeals court Judge Neil Gorsuch. Schumer says he doesn't think Gorsuch would serve as a check on Donald Trump or be a mainstream justice. The Associated Press has learned that agents from the U.S. Treasury Department recently obtained information about offshore financial transactions involving President Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort. The information was part of a federal anti-corruption probe into his work in Eastern Europe. Manafort has been a leading focus of the U.S. government's investigation into whether Trump associates coordinated with Moscow to meddle in the 2016 campaign. Statewide forecast for today includes showers and the possibility of some thunderstorms in southern Minnesota, highs ranging from the upper 30s to low 40s. It's cloudy and 38 right now here in the Twin Cities. More news ahead on Minnesota Public Radio News. It's 9:40.
At 10 o'clock, we talk about the politics of health care reform. At 7 o'clock tonight on Indivisible, you'll remember I talk about identity on Thursday night's National Call-In from public radio. I'm talking about the idea of voters who appear to vote against their own self-interest. I want to hear from you if you're one of those voters and what people believe about you that may not be right. That's Indivisible tonight at 7 o'clock. I'll see you there.
Support comes from locally owned R.F. Moeller Jeweler. R.F. Moeller chooses to sell forever marked diamonds because of the diamond company's social and environmental standards in those areas where their diamonds are mined. R.F. Moeller, why buy any other diamond?
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported in part by Target, committed to giving 5% of its profit to communities, more than $4 million every week. More information at target.com/community. Support for The Thread comes from the Friends of the University of Minnesota Libraries. Join them April 13th at Northrop as Elizabeth Colbert discusses her Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Sixth Extinction. Tickets at z.umn.edu/extinct.
I think it's basically Obamacare light. Keeps the subsidies, keeps the taxes for a year, then keeps the Cadillac tax forever, the tax on good insurance. Keeps the individual mandate, interestingly. You know, Republicans have complained for a year saying we didn't like that government was going to make you pay a penalty. Well, now instead of paying the penalty to the government, you pay the penalty to the insurance industry. There's also bailouts for the insurance industries. The one primary thing that's wrong with Obamacare that's most visible to everybody is that premiums are rising and through the roof, soaring in the individual market. That will happen under the Ryan plan as well because they do nothing to fix the fundamental problem.
That's Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, one of the members of the Senate who are not persuaded at this moment to support the ACHA. Again, the House apparently voting today. The Senate likely to make some changes. Allison Kojak with us from NPR. Leighton Koo with us from George Washington University. And Allison, to come to you on what Rand Paul said there, I mean, do you think there are significant enough changes that the Senate may make to this bill if it gets there that could bring some, you know, widespread support from the Senate? A lot of skeptics there so far.
You know, I'm taken by what Rand Paul said there because he said it doesn't fix the fundamental problem. And the fundamental problem is in healthcare costs a lot of money and people don't seem to want to pay it. And so the issue here is that if the Senate makes changes that, you know, address what senators want, which would be, you know, making sure more people get coverage and good coverage, that's not what the people in the House want. And so there's this fundamental divide between conservative Republicans in the House who wield a lot of power, who want to see people have to, you know, people just taking care of themselves, figuring out how to pay their health care on their own, and senators who are a little bit more moderate, even Republican senators, who want to see more people covered.
Wow, yeah.
Or at least the same number as are covered now.
Right. Call here from Christina in St. Paul. Hi, Christina. Thanks so much for waiting.
Thank you so much for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to share our situation. We're not millennials, and we're not invincibles. But we are small business owners, mm-hmm. and we can't afford to get our insurance off the exchange, so we have to pay for it in the private market. And after we pay our deductibles and our premiums, oh, also wanted to mention we have three children.
Okay.
We are looking at about $30,000 before we see any benefit.
Wow.
And my husband is a cancer survivor, and I also have intermittent depression and need coverage for mental health issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at this, and my husband and I are scared. It's, yes, they may not have a pre-existing condition clause where they can't deny us coverage.
Right.
Doesn't mean they can't price gouge us more than they already are. And I just want to make the effort, or make the statement that this intermediary of insurance, I feel like, is only there really to protect assets and not to provide medical care or cover medical expenses. We were talking about this. My husband and I were like, why do we pay this? Well, so that we can't go bankrupt.
Right.
In case he gets cancer again, so we don't have to pay $1 million, you know, because our insurance covers us 100% after we pay $30,000.
Right.
You know, because we were doing the math. And the reason why a lot of young people aren't in insurance is because they don't have assets to protect. This is the whole reason why we have insurance. And it ultimately is the reason why we need universal health care.
Christina, just a question here. When you said that you couldn't afford it through Minsure, are you saying you make too much money to get the subsidies through Minsure, or what?
Yep, we make too much money. Yep, but we're that middle class family that is being squeezed.
And have you had a year where you've had to spend $30,000 out of pocket?
Yes.
Wow, Leighton, what does the ACHA mean for a family like Christina's?
Well, so it's still going to have some of those same fundamental problems as far as paying for health care costs. If she makes, on one hand, because the tax credits in the new bill aren't tied to income unless you have a sort of relatively high income, she might be eligible for the tax credit, so she might do a little better in that case. On the other hand, to the extent that insurance becomes skinnier, still has these high deductibles, given, you know, particularly her husband's history, she may still be having high health care costs one way or the other. as Allison said, the underlying problem is that healthcare has become very expensive. To my mind, that's one of the underlying problems here in the debate. We could have been seeing a situation where there were more attempts to figure out how to make our healthcare system more efficient, do a better job in terms of providing preventive benefits, coordinating care for people who have more illnesses. But every time if we keep turning the apple cart over, it just makes it harder to make those long-term changes.
Layton, I wanted to ask you, Steve Parente from the Carlson School, I wonder if you know him.
Sure.
Yeah, I figured that. So his, we did a healthcare roundtable with a live audience where we had physicians and health policy grad students in the room. And Steve made the argument that what we ought to do is just provide everybody a catastrophic insurance policy, essentially. And then it will be up to, you know, individuals and families to pay for the other stuff that they need, with I guess, some incentives. He feels like that's one of the ways to get Americans to take more responsibility for their own health care. What are the upsides and downsides of that in your view?
The upside is that he's correct, that this would reduce the government cost for insurance by quite a lot. And would still sort of take care of some of the basic needs that people have at the high end of things. The problem particularly ends up being depending on how you define what that catastrophic coverage involves, and then the people who will continue to suffer the pinch are people with lower incomes. If you basically say, we're giving you the same package regardless of whether you're a millionaire or a pauper, well, a millionaire can buy it. Mm-hmm. A pauper still can't. So there's still that need for some sort of incentives to help people out who have lower incomes.
Gregory in St. Francis online says, I voted for Trump. I'm afraid they still won't cap the ever-rising prices of physicians, healthcare associations, hospitals, medical devices and supplies, and prescription pharmaceuticals. That's the problem that exists even after the gambling over patient risk is ended in the insurance game. Allison, what does this bill say about drug prices?
It doesn't really say anything at all. And, you know, the president talks quite a bit about drug prices, and he talks about wanting to get the government in the game of negotiating for lower drug prices, which, you know, it could actually make quite a difference if they were to, you know, combine the negotiating power of all the different Medicare plans and negotiate lower prices. But at this point, this Republican bill doesn't actually address drug prices in particular.
And Layton, you agree with that, it sounds like, from what you've said.
That's right. The bill as it stands now doesn't touch those issues at all. But it's true. The president has talked about negotiating. He's even talked about importing drugs. But that runs very contrary to a lot of vested interest, and sort of the Republican mainstream is opposed to that.
Call here from John in Minneapolis. Hey, good morning, John. Hi. Thanks for waiting.
Good morning. Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just curious what your guests would say. I'm 35. My wife and I have been uninsured now for 2 years. Have paid the penalty because it's less than what it would cost, almost by half what mm-hmm. it would have cost us to get insurance. We're one of those middle class couples.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we're talking about having a baby. So we're thinking, yeah, we need to maybe fork out the money for it. But I'm actually looking forward to the conservative plan for the tax credit initially, and then we'll see how it turns out. But personally, I feel like, isn't this just the method by which eventually we break the wills of both sides? Legislation somewhere down the road is passed that addresses some of the drug prices, the cost of insurance, and of course breaks the will of legislators that ideologically are making these laws or not. What do your guests think is the best case scenario after all of this hoopla, Obamacare, probably Trump care, and then what comes next, and hopefully optimistically?
Okay, good question. Allison, would you tackle that?
That's a tough one. Well, I think, you know, if you're going to give best case scenario without ideology, it would be that, you know, somehow this particular plan can't get through and Republicans and Democrats get together and figure out how to actually solve some of the problems that are nagging the current system. And, you know, maybe that is getting rid of the individual mandate, which is really the biggest thing that Republicans are against, mm-hmm. and coming up with some other solution. But instead of saying we have to, quote, repeal Obamacare because that's what they promised, figuring out how to stabilize the market and how to deal with medical costs, because that's really where the solution lies. And there are a lot of good ideas out there, and there are a lot of things that people know they can do, but there's no will to work together. And so if this utterly failed, and I don't want to say I'm wishing that to be the case, but if this utterly failed and the Democrats' sort of desire for universal health care utterly failed and they had to come together somewhere in the middle, they could actually make some improvements that would hopefully help reduce insurance cost and healthcare costs.
You know, Leighton, I really hear what Allison is saying when she says there are some really good ideas out there. They kind of get swamped by the politics of this. What do you think the best case after the chaos could be?
I'm always afraid to prognosticate because I'm not very good at it. But I think Allison's appeal for trying to sort of restart these discussions in a serious bipartisan fashion, agreeing on what's possible, is a better way of doing things. I mean, the part of the problem right now is the motivation has been to sort of quickly do something so people can feel that they can meet some political promises that were made. And I understand the politics of that, but that's not necessarily what's in the long-term best interest of the American people.
Megan says on Twitter, I have terrible coverage and it's expensive. I would prefer to pass on all of it. Another listener here says, I worked on MnSure implementation. The major problem is insurance companies don't want to cover rural people. The AHCA will not help. Leighton, what's your opinion on that?
It varies from place to place as far as who are rural people covered, but they're always having the toughest problem. And it's certainly true that the health care bill being discussed in Congress doesn't make any steps to sort of help increase the availability of health insurance for rural people.
Call here from Justin in Winona. Hi, Justin. What are you thinking about?
I guess I'm concerned because of all the talk about Medicaid being cut in the future. My mother is on Medicaid because she's permanently disabled, and I'm wondering if there's maybe some data to support the economic impact that's going to have on people like, say, my age, who are 39, 40 years old, who are going to have to help take care of their parents and help them stand their medication, and that's going to take away from my income and my family. That's kind of my concern. I'm just wondering if there's maybe some data to kind of show an impact.
Okay. Leighton, can I come back to you on that?
Sure. And the answer is some of this is tough. I will say we've done some economic analysis of the effects of repealing some of the elements of Obamacare. They don't fit in exactly with what happened, what's in discussion in Congress right now. But what it suggests is that my guess is that the bill originally had Obamacare been completely repealed. Our estimate was that Minnesota could lose about 50,000 jobs in a year. My guess is that with the scaled back bill and with some of the tax changes that are made in it, maybe the effect would be half or thereabouts to that level. So there are some broader economic impacts, even for people who aren't getting insurance from the exchanges or through Medicaid. We could see job loss. We could see some fairly substantial reductions in state economies because the amount of federal funding that will come in will be much less.
Farnaby says on Twitter, I work in insurance. The ACA had problems. This solves none. It introduces more. And the newest rider to attract the Freedom Caucus is worse yet. So, Allison, back to this question I raised at the news break, which is, do you see significant changes happening to this bill to try to win votes that will mean anything once it gets to the Senate, if it gets to the Senate?
Well, like I said, they're looking today at removing these essential health benefits.
Right.
That doesn't necessarily mean anything when it gets to the Senate, because people don't think that can pass the Senate, not because the senators are against it, which they may be, but because they have to pass this law using a special, procedure that only lets them, work on things that impact the budget or taxes. And most arguments are that these essential benefits don't impact the budget or taxes. So, you know, at this point, nothing in the House that I see is going to change before it goes to the Senate to bring in more senators to, that will vote for it.
Okay. Call here from Jonathan in River Falls. Hey, Jonathan, hi.
Good morning.
Hey. What are you thinking about? What's your question?
I'm a 26-year-old, you know, one of these invincibles here. I'm an adjunct professor of history.
Okay.
And looking at how the exchange works, I look at my monthly bills with both student loans and rent. And now, you know, I'm just really worried that here in the future I could see my bills go up even more.
And so meaning that the ACHA doesn't give you much comfort on reining in health care costs?
Oh, none at all. And I was in the emergency room recently, and I'm looking at a bill that's going to cost me 3 months' worth of pay.
Yeah. Layton, is he right to be concerned?
He's right to be concerned, again, because of the changes in some of the tax credit provisions. Right now, while he's 26, he might get access to a tax credit that he can't use at the particular time. But as he gets older, which I think is what he's talking about, his worries, he will see his health care prices going up even faster. So it's a trade-off. The bill was designed, as Allison mentioned, to make premiums a little less expensive for young people after you when you factor in the changes for the tax credits. But they'll almost certainly mean that people who are older in their, say, mid-40s to 60s are going to pay a lot more.
Layton, really a pleasure to have your analysis and experience with this as part of the conversation. Thank you very much.
A pleasure.
Allison, quick question for you. I've been hearing about single payer. That's not on the table, no matter how many people out here in Minnesota want it or what Bernie Sanders says, right?
No, it is not on the table as long as Republicans are controlling the House and Senate.
And you're saying because that's just something that cannot win the kind of support that you need across the political divide.
No, absolutely not. No, I mean, that is something that liberal Democrats are very, very invested in, the idea of bringing, you know, the entire healthcare system into a single payer system. But, you know, with the divisions in Congress, there are a huge number of people who just aren't even willing to entertain the idea of a single payer health system.
Allison, I know you have a long day. Really grateful you spent some time with us today. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Allison Kojak is the health policy correspondent for NPR. You will be hearing lots of her reporting, I know, throughout the day and into the evening, and hopefully tomorrow morning as well when you wake up for Morning Edition. I have to say this, that health care roundtable that we did in the forum here at NPR has really gotten a lot of traction on podcasts. I recommend it. Great questions from the doctors and the health policy grad students in the audience. And our panel was just excellent. So the Healthcare Roundtable, you can find it in the podcast. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you get your podcasts.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by Robbins Kaplan LLP, helping clients cut through complexity, get to the heart of the problem, and rewrite their odds in high-stakes litigation. RobbinsKaplan.com.